Welcome to Vashon 250. As America observes its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum have partnered to create our own recognition of this important milestone. We are looking back at what has happened in America since its beginning and examining how, over time, it has influenced our life on Vashon Island. In this second quarter of 2026, we continue to look at several of the famous high points that ultimately led to the Revolutionary War. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Holman.
Welcome to episode number 16, Bunker Hill. We generally opt not to focus on battles of the Revolution because it would be easy to spend a lot of time on the blood and guts, winner and loser aspects of the era. Today, however, we are looking at the Battle of Bunker Hill, the outcome of which set a tone for how both sides would engage throughout the war. For this, a map of 1775 Boston would be handy because the geography of Boston played an important role in colonist success. Maybe a couple of toy-led soldiers would be helpful too. The Battle of Bunker Hill was fought on June 17, 1775, during the siege of Boston in the very first stage of the American Revolutionary War. The battle is named after Bunker Hill in Charlestown, Massachusetts, which was peripherally involved. It was the original objective of both the colonial and British troops, though the majority of combat took place on the adjacent hill, which became known as Breed's Hill. Boston was situated on a peninsula at the time and was largely protected from close approach by the expanses of water surrounding it, which were dominated by British warships. In the aftermath of the battles of Lexington and Concord on April 19, 1775, the colonial militia of some 15,000 men had surrounded the town and besieged it under the command of Artemus Ward. They controlled the only land access to Boston itself, called the Roxbury Neck, but they were unable to contest British domination of the waters of the harbor. The British troops occupied the city, a force of about 6,000 under the command of General Thomas Gage, and they were able to be resupplied and reinforced by sea. Land across the water from Boston contained a number of hills which would be used to the colonial advantage. The height of Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill allowed for artillery to be placed on the hills and used to bombard the city until the occupying army evacuated it or surrendered. It was this in mind that Henry Knox led the noble train of artillery to transport cannon from Fort Ticonderoga in New York. The American colonists also benefited from a British mistake. The British retreat from Concord had ended in Charlestown, but General Gage did not fortify the hills around it, instead withdrew his troops to Boston, turning the entire Charlestown Peninsula into a no man's land. This was a strategic error that the colonists took full advantage of. On June 13, 1775, the leaders of the colonial forces besieging Boston learned that the British were planning to send troops out from the city to fortify the unoccupied hills surrounding the city, which would give them control of Boston Harbor. In response, 1,200 colonial troops under the command of William Prescott stealthily occupied Bunker Hill and Breed's Hill. They constructed a strong redoubt on Breed's Hill overnight, as well as similar fortified lines along the Charlestown Peninsula. By daybreak of June 17th, about 4 days later, the British became aware of the presence of colonial forces on the peninsula and mounted an attack against them. Two assaults on the colonial positions were repulsed with significant British casualties, but the redoubt was captured on their third assault. The colonists retreated over Bunker Hill, leaving the British in control of the peninsula. Battle was a victory for the British, but a very costly one, and a sobering experience for them. They incurred many more casualties than the Americans had sustained, including many officers. Battle had demonstrated that inexperienced militia were able to stand up to regular army troops in battle. Subsequently, the battle discouraged the British from any further frontal attacks against well-defended front lines. American casualties were much fewer, although their losses included General Joseph Warren and Major Andrew McCleary, the final casualty of the battle. The battle led the British to adopt a more cautious planning and maneuver execution in future engagements, which was evident in the subsequent New York and New Jersey campaign. The costly engagement also convinced the British of the need to hire a substantial number of Hessian, or German, auxiliaries to bolster their strength in the force of the new and formidable Continental Army. Ultimately, Hessians were 25% of the British force. If you compare a map of Boston in 1775 with the modern 2026 city, the topography of the Revolution is no longer. Over the last 250 years, there has been a great deal of fill brought in to help the city grow. Industrial areas, housing, and other infrastructure typical of a large city are in place. A good comparison would be Seattle's own Denny Regrade, where hills were leveled and the soil used for infill where today we have sports stadiums. So, Bruce, there have been a number of events over the last 250 years. What are some of the most significant of these historic events as they relate to Bunker Hill?
Well, as you pointed out, Bunker Hill was kind of a pyrrhic victory for the British. They won the battle but had heavy losses, particularly among their officer corps. General Gage was relieved of command and replaced by General Howe, who was much less inventive and much more of a hardliner. And the British had to turn to foreign mercenaries, as you pointed out, to the Hessians, to bolster their forces in the colonies. So the Americans lost the battle, but proved that they could stand against British regulars and hold their own. So we've had a number of examples throughout American history where you see those kind of early defeats being followed by later victories and by substantial changes in the nature of what the struggle is about. And of course, one of the most remarkable of these is the American labor struggle. Early labor strikes, particularly in the post-Civil War period in the late 19th century, were often not successful. The railroad strikes, the strikes against the mining industry, the strikes, the industrial strikes. There was a long stretch in the late 19th and early 20th century when strikes were not successful and were put down, and often bloodily put down, with the use of either Pinkerton guards or U.S. Army troops. And yet what it led to in the 1930s was a series of very successful strikes during the Great Depression, particularly in the automotive industry, where you begin to get, after World War II, the flowering of the American labor movement. So there's this long sort of period of 50, 60 years of labor being on the defensive, striking and being constantly sort of beaten down. And then all of a sudden with the Great Depression, you begin to see that change. And then after World War II, sort of a flowering of the labor movement. A good example of that is when you look at how much of the labor in the United States was unionized. In the 1920s, it was only 10%. By the 1950s, it's a third of American workers are unionized. And then by 2010, it's back down to 10%, particularly after the Reagan sort of breaking of the Air Traffic Controllers Union and the move by Republicans and Republican administrations to weaken the labor legislation. But if you look at it in a long sense, like you do, can look back at Bunker Hill, it really set up the Americans for success. Another example, of course, is the civil rights movement. You have the imposition of black laws right after the Civil War. The sort of reinstitution of kinds of servitude, limitations on black civil rights, with Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, you get the concept of separate but equal is equal, and so you get the institution of segregation throughout the South and throughout many other parts of the country. While that was going on, you have the rise of the NAACP, you have the rise of Ida B. Wells as a sort of a muckraking journalist advocating for African-American rights. You have a number of things going on in the 1910s and 20s into the 1930s. that are sort of pushing for African-American civil rights. And then after World War II, with the Brown versus the Board of Education decision, and with the rise of the sort of modern civil rights movement, African-American civil rights movement, in the late 50s and 1960s into the 1970s, you have a major change in American society. And today, where there's basically segregation is sort of illegal. I mean, it happens, but there's a lot of legal constraints against overt segregation and overt racism. And so you have that sort of 50, 60-year struggle against the imposition of the black laws and of segregation and of Jim Crow that ends up in a victory with Brown versus the Board of Education. Of course, it takes another 30 years for that to be implemented, but once it is, you have sort of the emergence of a modern concept of equality in the United States. And then also out of that, you get the flowering of a whole range of other rights movements. You know, the American Indian Rights Movement, the Chicano Rights Movement, La Raza. You get the emergence of the Asian American rights movement, you know, LGBTQ rights movement. So the American Civil Rights Movement that traces back to the post-Civil War Reconstruction really is a very successful sort of 100-year struggle that in the end leads us to a society that sort of recognizes the inherent equality of citizens.
Although we still haven't passed the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment.
Well, that's another piece of it. With women's rights, you have the same kind of thing where you have a long struggle for women to recognize their rights. Women begins with the suffrage movement, and of course in 1920 you get the amendment that allows women to vote, although many states had passed women's rights to vote legislation before that. Washington State, actually 1910, women get the right to vote. But what you have is a struggle that you begin to see the emergence, particularly in the 1960s and 1970s, of first and then second and then ultimately third wave feminism that, you know, begins to change the role of women in society. And you can look at the Equal Rights Amendment as a failure. And in a sense, it was to get it sort of inculcated into the Constitution. But in reality, most of the things that the Equal Rights Amendment was seeking have actually been accomplished through other kinds of legislation and through social change. So it's sort of to me, a sort of sense of initial defeats don't necessarily end movements. And
true.
It's sort of that
true
persistence. And I think that takes us back to Bunker Hill and how significant that was in terms of the Americans, even though they lost the battle, they won the war. And that's sort of an important thing to keep in mind. And you see that in things also like the war on drugs. I mean, the war on drugs with the DARE programs and those kinds of things in the 1980s and 1990s, end up with an opioid sort of explosion in the 2010s that decimates big parts of American society and ultimately lead to where we are today, where you're starting to see a more of a reaction against drug use and drug importation. And, you know, whether you agree with it or not, you know, the sort of interdiction of drug transportation through the Caribbean and through the Pacific from South and Central America has been taken on, and it's a serious disruption of the flow of drugs. So again, you know, it's that sort of early defeats don't necessarily mean long-term failure.
So if we look at current times, let's say the last 5 or 6 years, what sort of similar victories for the British and the established precedent there, what do you see impacting us more recently?
Well, there's things, of course, like the COVID. I mean, COVID is just a fascinating example of how, you know, the science, you know, reacts very quickly and is mobilized relatively effectively to, you know, stop the spread of COVID. And of course, it becomes a kind of Pyrrhic victory. I mean, what it does, it sort of facilitates the growth of an anti-vaxxer movement that had been there before, but sort of gets an additional sort of boost from the "you can't tell me that I need to be vaccinated," and the whole sort of campaign to wear masks, to socially distance, to not have spreader events, all those kind of things, which were essential to us getting control over COVID, end up in effect being pushed back by more conservative, more anti-scientific sort of elements of society that look at it and say, "Hey, you can't tell us what to do." And so we're at a situation now where if we were to have another COVID sort of pandemic hit, we'd have no place to go.
So we haven't necessarily prepared this. Let's go back 100 years to the last pandemic. Mm-hmm. Was the outcome similar?
Very, very similar. You know, Nancy Bristow did her PhD dissertation on the Spanish flu, or what's called the influenza pandemic of 1918. It got the name Spanish flu because it actually started in the trenches in Europe and actually got spread through both both armies on both sides of World War I. But because of concerns of security and press sort of censorship, word never got out until the flu reached Spain. Spain, not a combatant in World War I, the newspapers in Spain reported it, and so it became known as the Spanish flu. And really, it was the trench warfare flu of World War I, but nobody reported it because of sort of the fear of the other side learning that the other side had this epidemic going on, this pandemic going on, although it went on both sides. So the Spanish flu is there, the parallels with COVID are just amazing. I mean, the same kind of pushback against, you know, wearing masks, against vaccines were not developed at the level that they are now, you know, but pushback against potentials of vaccination, pushbacks against all these public health kinds of things, you know, closing movie theaters, closing public places, you know, asking for social distancing, you know, isolating people who had contracted the influenza. It was very similar. And on another level, and I think this is fascinating, by the 1920s, people just sort of forgot about it. They wanted to forget about it. And I think you see that right now in 2026. You know, people talk about COVID, but not in the way that we talked about COVID 3 or 4 years ago. Right. I mean, people want to move on from it. And that's exactly what happened with the 1918 influenza pandemic.
And did that influenza outbreak have the same, I guess, societal change that we've seen with COVID? I mean, we've seen just a lot of things change, and will they ever go back to the way they were? Who knows? But it's a different world today.
Yeah, and the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, were a very different world than the world of pre-World War I America, the 1910s. I mean, the flappers, you know, the sort of speakeasies, you know, prohibition. I mean, all of those things were going on in the 1920s. The political corruption, you know, of Teapot Dome and the Harding administration, all of those kind of things. The parallels between the 1920s and the 2020s are incredibly remarkable and striking when you start looking at them sort of element by element. And it's that idea that we go through these traumas, and then it's sort of like, how do you forget the trauma?
Yeah, and so we're a little off track for this episode. Maybe we'll have to come back to that at a future time. In the meantime, let's get back on track here, and with some of the more recent things. We started with COVID, and then you were going to head into, I believe, NATO.
Well, yeah, I think what you see, again, you think of this concept of Bunker Hill as a pyrrhic victory for the British. They win the battle, but they lose the war, you know, and I think we're seeing those kinds of things going on with NATO right now. I mean, NATO is being sidelined by the current Trump administration. And in the future, that's not going to be a good thing for the United States. I mean, the Atlantic Alliance has held the world at peace, you know, for
70 years.
Yeah, 70 years. And we're seeing that threatened, particularly as Russia and China begin to emerge as serious competitors. Particularly in the situation we are now with the war in Iran, and you know, and so it's very difficult to know, but yeah, I think definitely you see that kind of pyrrhic victory kind of idea going on. Also with Venezuela, I mean, you know, this idea of going in and capturing the leader of a country and expecting that country to go on as normal, and
whatever normal means.
Yeah, whatever normal in Venezuela was. I mean, it's sort of like, wait a minute, what's going to happen? And we're too early to know. But I suspect in the next year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years from now, we're going to look back at that sort of adventure in Venezuela, and things have gone to custard probably in Venezuela in the next 3-4 years. Maybe not, but probably so. And then you look at the war that's going on right now in Iran. I mean, America goes in with superior aerial forces, Air Force forces, a bombing campaign that wipes out the Iranian Navy, wipes out much of their defense capacities. And yet, you know, where are we? You know, and we're recording this in sort of the middle of April, and we don't know where it's going to go. And I suspect it's like in World War II, where the aerial bombing campaigns in Japan and Germany devastated German and Japanese cities, but it actually increased the production because so much less went into domestic production. You know, and it increased the population of Germany and Japan's allegiance to their government because these foreign invaders were bombing them from the sky. And so, I mean, World War II becomes a great example of the limits of the power of air bombings. Yeah, you can wipe things out, but do you make the changes that you need to make unless you put boots on the ground? And in both Japan and Germany, we put boots on the ground in the Pacific, in the island campaign of sort of attacking and capturing island after island on our way to invading Japan, and of course that was only sort of prevented by the dropping of the atomic bombs. And then in Europe, we actually had to invade France at D-Day and slog our way into Germany while the Russians were doing the same thing on the Eastern Front. And you think, wow, I mean, did the air bombing campaign really win the war? No, it didn't. It was boots on the ground. And if you look at the Iran conflict, are we going to have boots on the ground in Iran? Wow, I don't know.
Well, and the same thing could be said for Iraq. We started that started out as an air war.
Yeah.
Pretty soon.
Desert Storm, yeah. You know, the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War. We had boots on the ground, and how did those turn out?
Yeah.
You know, and Truman, to your example in Vietnam, you were boots on the ground in Vietnam, and how effective was that? I mean,
not that effective in the end, obviously, but it was for some time, indeed.
Yeah. Well, yeah, right. But at what cost?
And exactly. Exactly.
That's what you have to go back to. So I think there's a lot going on right now in this current 2020s and the late 2010s and the early 2020s that are reflective of that idea of you've got to be really very, very careful about these early victories because they can become pyrrhic. They can turn on you and burn you up, basically.
Yeah. So let's bring this home to our little island here. We've had our own events over time. Let's talk about them.
Yeah, on Vashon, it's important to remember there have been a number of things in the past where there are what I call these kind of pyrrhic victories for the island that, you know, are cautionary tales in a sense. And one of them, of course, is the Vashon Ferry District. I mean, Vashon Islanders get so fed up with ferry strikes and the monopoly by the Black Paw Fleet that they ultimately, in 1948, create their own ferry district. Well, it's that old adage, you got to be careful what you wish for.
Right.
I mean, you get your own ferries, and you're able to run your own ferry system. But it was a major headache for the whole 4 years that they're running the ferry system. You know, you just, the idea, you have to get the boats, and the boats that were available from King County and from some of the private sort of ferry carriers were their cast off, so they were leaky and they were breaking down, and they were sort of like,
just like today.
Exactly. There's lots of parallels, and so yeah, you win a victory in the sense that you form your own ferry district, you're able to control your own destiny, but then you have to make it work, and of course, what rescued the Vashon Ferry District was the creation of the Washington State Ferry System. And Vashon was able to turn all their ferries, all their operations over to the Washington State Ferry System and essentially sort of get out of the ferry business. But for 4 years, it was this kind of cobbled together, can we make it work kind of thing. Yeah, so it was a victory, but it came with substantial cost. You know, another example is in the 1980s, when Vashon decides to form its own park district, and that came with the availability of the Nike site, both the launch site over at Paradise Ridge, which becomes the Paradise Ridge Horse Park, and Sunrise Ridge, and those become available, and the park district gets involved, the health, what becomes the health center becomes involved, and those are turned over to Vashon Parks. They begin to buy some parks like Liza Beulah. And then King County in 1983 says, well, we're going to get out of the park business on Vashon, and we're going to turn over all these parks to Vashon. Great, except you got to maintain these parks. These parks were not, for the most part, well-developed. And so Vashon, it's sort of like the gift that continues to kill you as you move on. And what's powerful about that is the sense that Vashon, over time, was able to pull that together and to create a very viable park district that today is the gem of the island. And so, yeah, these pyrrhic victories don't always end in sort of defeat, but they also take some struggle to get there. So, yeah, you have some of that. And then from the other side, you look at the Glacier battle. I mean, Glacier won that battle time after time after time, beginning in the late 90s, all the way up into 2010, 2011. Every time it went to court, every time it came into a conflict, you know, Glacier won. And then right at the end, things flip around, you know, Save Our Islands win, and we get this tremendous sort of a park area on Maury Island for the island. So, you know, pyrrhic victories, you know, can be mixed.
They can be. Good. Well, with that, let's wrap up. Next time around, we will be looking at the Olive Branch petition from July 8, 1775. Thanks for joining us.
That's a wrap to this episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us again each week through the end of 2026 for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island history. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic we might want to cover, please drop an email to vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a production of Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum. Our producer is Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services for business credit departments across the nation. For more information, go to nacmbcs.org. We appreciate their support. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.